Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Tonight is Thursday, March 4th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, and then Permaculture and Profits with Eric Tonesmeyer. And Eric's going to join me for a discussion of our documentary this evening, Killer at Large, about obesity, particularly focusing on obesity in children and the relationship to our food supply. Our theme for today is from one of my favorite oldie but goodie tunes. It's time to get on down to the real nitty-gritty. And with that, you'll be surprised by my pick for really the story of the week, which comes from Tracy, California. The local government of Tracy, California has announced that it's charging a user fee of $48 to citizens if they want to be able to use the 911 service, the emergency service. Their option, if they don't pay the $48 fee, is instead to pay $300 per time that they call 911. So you can imagine in the middle of an emergency calling 911 and getting hit with a $300 bill, particularly if you can't afford it. I say that that's the story this week because I think it's just the beginning of what we're about to face in terms of a shift in costs and inflated costs into the average person in the United States, not just the United States. It's happening globally. The U.S. Post Office is canceling Saturday delivery, something they've been trying to do for years. Part of that comes from the fact that they need to deliver mail to many, many more places, but they have a lot less bill to mail to deliver. There's much more electronic bill paying being done, much more electronic online, and the digital technology is revolutionizing everything, not the least of which is advertising. Kiplinger last week reported that a $600 billion marketing and advertising industry is being revolutionized. Targeted campaigns are now up to 75% of spending on ads. That means we're literally going from a world of mass marketing to very targeted marketing. So we're going from a world of Madison Avenue reigning supreme to Facebook reigning supreme, and that has a lot of implications to us because now we're the ones who are going to get targeted. A very important indicator I keep talking about, I'm just going to keep bringing it up, is the state and local budget cycle. The real lead story that we all need to watch is what happens in California. My prediction is that we'll know 2 months after the close of the state and local budget cycles how the economy is going to fare through the state and local cutbacks this year. My prediction is we're going to see a real rough time in the real estate market after we go through the state and local cycle and see what kind of cutbacks and layoffs happen and how they ripple through the economy. Remember, we are all legally liable for the federal, state, and local debt and deficits, particularly whether you're a taxpayer or a resident. We're all going to feel that, and that's why I think the story of what's happening in Tracy, California is so important. I've written about something on the blog called participatory budgeting, and if you're interested, do a search on the blog and take a look at it. What happened in Latin America in the 90s when taxpayers and residents faced the same kind of cutbacks in services and changes in state and local budgets is they literally got into the room and said, okay, from now on, government is not going to invent the budgets. Each budget cycle, we, the citizens, are going to participate. And it's really a way of getting deeply into the numbers and finding a way of reengineering the state and local budgets with the help of citizen involvement. There's a lot of efficiencies to come out of them and a lot of truth to be told if citizens really get in, particularly if we look at where the money's been disappearing to and how to get it back. There's signs coming globally around the world that food inflation is coming. I spoke today with the chief financial officer of a resource company that's now one of the largest holders of farmland in Canada, and he pointed out that the average age for the American and Canadian farmer is 58 to 60, and most of those farmers have no heirs. A lot of farmland is about to change hands over the next 10 to 20 years. It's a real strategic inflection point in the society. The signs of the bailout cleanup continue. We're watching in the news the financially healthy parts of AIG continue to get parsed out to the old line insurance companies. The most recent is the sale of the Asian life insurance business from AIG to Prudential for $35 billion. In my opinion, because of the role of AIG as a critical player in the black budget and U.S. intelligence agency operations, I think there's a deeper story here. That is, the sort of the guy who did the dirty work is being broken up with the funds going back to pay off the Fed loans, and that dirty work is basically the part of the financial coup d'etat. And with the company being broken up, the trail is gone dead, as you will. I think if the truth be known, a lot of the money that's gone missing, deep in the bowels of AIG's records, there's a lot of story to be told there. Washington has been very busy, and it's a lot to be terrified about. I used to have, when I worked in the Bush administration, I used to have a guy who ran my accounting operation who said that an auditor was a person who bayoneted the victim, and that's kind of what we're seeing in Washington with reform literally being something that I think is going to end up bayoneting the victim. We've got lots of different kinds of reforms going on. Number one, healthcare reform. The president is still very aggressively pursuing healthcare reform. We had Warren Buffett, and you can see the article up on the blog, calling healthcare an economic tapeworm. I thought it was interesting that he used the economic tapeworm symbol. His description of healthcare as an economic tapeworm was basically saying cost was the problem. Interestingly enough, I agree with that. But he didn't get specific as what that meant or how you'd fix it. So we're not quite clear whether he was referring to the sort of rigged pharmaceutical insurance and hospital corporation profits, or instead he was talking about services to people in the last 6 months of life, or both. But I think it's true that where you need revolutionary reform is on the cost side. And indeed, that goes back to the food supply. It's something that we're going to talk about when we talk about the documentary this evening, Killer at Large. Financial reform going on at the same time. There's a special effort by Dodd and Corker in the Senate to get something passed this year. They're trying to build a bipartisan effort, and we'll see if it happens. I've been working on a special review of that. It's a little bit tough. It's 1,700 pages, if you can imagine that, almost as long as healthcare reform. So we're going to do a special report on that when we do the precious metals update next week. Food safety reform continues. Very disturbing news that McCain has now entered legislation to control vitamins and supplements. You get the real impression that the natural health industry is literally going to have their revenues clawed back by the medical tapeworm, the traditional tapeworm that needs those revenues. And I think behind the scenes what you really have is a fight. As more and more people leave the traditional medical industry, you have a fight to get those revenues back. Now, we have election pressures, and interestingly enough, if you look at sort of what Congress is doing, it really is not reflecting the will of the people, and we sort of wonder how things are going to turn out as we get closer and closer to election. There's a very interesting poll up at Rasmussen Reports. I wanted to focus your attention on. I put it up on the blog if you want to read it. Let me just read it. Confidence in the economy's future is at lowest point of Obama's presidency. 42% of American adults now expect the U.S. economy to be weaker in a year's time. 51% of adults expect the economy to be stronger in 5 years. 25% expect the economy to be weaker in 5 years. That's a pretty high number in America. Let's see, what else? 58% say the current state of the U.S. economy has caused more stress. And by resounding numbers, 46% of all adults now say it is at least somewhat likely the United States will enter an economic depression similar to the 1930s within the next few years. That's an extraordinary number. And what is clear is that all very high numbers say that the most important issue before us is the economy. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens when Congress breaks and goes home for the elections and has to really touch the electorate. One of the things I put up on the blog several weeks ago and said that I wanted to talk about, and we really need to talk about it now because we're in March, is the 2010 census. If you do a search on the blog, it's called A Solari Report, the 2010 Census. And I wanted to focus your attention on it because, as you know, I have a real concern for government getting ownership and control of data about all of us. The government is required for the purposes of counts for elections to do a census every 10 years. This year, generally the censuses, in my opinion, have become more and more invasive, asking for more and more data. And my concern is not so much about the census and the data they're collecting this year, but if you look at the contractors that the government is using to do the census and their ability to aggregate lots of other data with very impeccably organized and collected data from the census as to location and place base, the use of that data potentially is very disturbing. If you want to understand where some of my concerns about data collection come from, you should read the article I wrote called The Data Beast, but also read a wonderful book by Edwin Black on the role of IBM in the Holocaust and the importance to the Holocaust and the Nazi regime of excellent data on the citizens and collecting that in censuses. Interestingly enough, IBM, along with Lockheed Martin, is a lead contractor on this census. So it's chilling. I asked my attorney to help me prepare this report, and one of the things I asked her to focus on was what was the penalty for not complying. And it turns out we described the penalties. It's a $1,000 fine or $500 fine if you give false answers, but it's a $100 fine if you refuse to comply and provide information for the census. So needless to say, Fitz, I've instructed everybody here in Hickory Valley that we are not replying to the census. My understanding is they're planning on hiring a tremendous number of temporary workers, so don't be surprised if somebody shows up at your door to collect information, and if they do, I will just simply be declining and happy to pay the $100 fine if that is what it takes. So check it out, Solari Report on the 2010 Census. The politics in the Middle East continue to heat up. We're coming into a very interesting time. We're coming into the opium harvest season, which is, as you can imagine, a very significant business in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and through and into Turkey. As the economy continues to be difficult globally and people choke on more and more debt, whether sovereign government or consumers, the cash flows from that business are going to become more and more important. So don't be surprised to see more squabbling over those cash flows or for that to impact those trade routes going in and out of Afghanistan. The politics on Iran sanctions continue to increase pressure on Russia to help the U.S. try and box China, China being a very important, increasingly important trade partner and strategic partner of Iran. The risk of war in the Middle East continues to be present, particularly given the difficulties in the economy. More on that March 18th. We're going to be talking with Jim Norman about oil and economic warfare in the Middle East in the third Solari report of March. Europe continues to struggle with their debt problems, and one of the things that is coming out more and more is the role of the banks and the investment banks in both the buildup of debt and derivatives that is causing problems, throughout Europe. You know, that's on top of all the fraudulent securities that were sold that had to be bailed out. But now, in addition, we're watching investigation of the role of the hedge funds in driving the euro down. We saw this week the euro hit an all-time, or the price of gold hit an all-time high against the euro. An amazing event, Goldman Sachs in its latest SEC filings has listed in its risk factors the fact that it's getting tremendous coverage. What does it call it? It says, adverse publicity could have a negative impact on our reputation and the morale and performance of our employees, which could adversely affect our businesses and operations. And you go on through the sort of Goldman's reaction, and Goldman is literally positioning the amount of criticism it's been getting in the financial blogosphere as literally a mishandling of public relations. Now, this is an amazing sort of reconfiguration of the problem. Rather than saying that they have created a fence from outlandish speculative behavior that is unbelievably damaging to the real economy and to the, you know, the American people and people worldwide, whether it's investors or communities or citizens, they're terming their substantive harm done as a mishandling of public relations. But it's quite an astonishing admission for any investment bank to make in its SEC filings that this has gotten bad enough to hurt their business. But it's true. Slowly, constituencies around the world are connecting with each other with respect to the predatory role that investment banks and hedge funds are continuing to have at the expense of the real economy. We saw a report this week. The combined assets of the four biggest banks are now 32% of all the deposits in the FDIC-insured institutions. That's an extraordinary number. But Simon Johnson pointed out, this is quite amazing, the combined assets of our six biggest banks 15 years ago totaled 17% of GDP. By 2006, that number stood at 63%. It's probably up even much further today. Those are extraordinary concentrations, and they reflect, not surprisingly, extraordinary political influence. We saw this week it announced that Paul Volcker and the administration are backing off of a hardline reform to prevent the banks to do proprietary trading, which is basically the speculative and predatory behavior that has got everybody so riled up in Europe. So literally what we get is a picture of a financial system that's out of control, doing enormous predatory damage. Nobody knows how to stop it. Last but not least, we see earthquakes in Chile, Taiwan. I'm reminded of the half-past human prediction of six large earthquakes. George Ura over at People Economics has been covering it, and Urban, his other website, Urban Survival. But it's a reminder of the weather and geophysical stress that we are, we've been handling, and we're going to keep handling. Our hero of the week is someone you wouldn't expect. Richard Carmona is the vice chairman of the Spa Canyon Ranch in Tucson, Arizona, who, after leaving the Bush administration as Surgeon General, outed Washington's role in literally poisoning our children. He's one of the people featured in the documentary Killer at Large, this evening, Killer at Large. And again, if you haven't seen it, I can't recommend it to you enough. But a very brave man and somebody who clearly took his official duties seriously was very frustrated. Okay, very quickly, asked Catherine a lot of good questions. First one, I've retired from federal service and would like to roll over my TSP savings into a physical gold IRA. Is this a good idea? If you look in the archive that we do of all the precious metals Soleri reports with Franklin Sanders, we did a whole Soleri report on the precious metals using your IRA to buy precious metals. Focused more on both what you could do with gold money and what you could do with sterling trust, and went through those, and I would really encourage you to listen to that more carefully. Yes, I think it's a good idea. The question you need to make sure of is if you have if you expect to take withdraw, if you're at a point where you're going to do withdrawals in the near future, you may want to leave some of that liquid. You can always split your IRA between that and other places. You don't have to do all of it there. So I would really encourage you to listen to the old Solari report. Are you aware of any examples of the infiltration and intentional misinformation within the alternative media? Absolutely. There are hundreds of examples. If you go to the blog and do a search for the censorship of Catherine on KPFA Radio, you'll find a series of blog posts about my being kicked off, my community business radio show on Flashpoints being kicked off at the height of the takeover of Freddie and Fannie and the passage of the housing bill. If you do a search for two blog posts called Material Omission Part 1 and Part 2, you'll read a whole bunch about censorship in the alternative media related to 9/11, as well as some funny business by David Corton, a fairly well-known alternative writer in the economic area. I've seen many cases of another great example. When I was writing about Enron, there was one member of our network who kept trying to post all my stuff up at Free Republic, and it was getting scrubbed out of the comments literally within minutes of being posted. Another wonderful story, and I could go on and on, was when I first published Narco Dollars for Dummies. A whole series of people in the alternative press who were supposed to be trying to stop the war on drugs ended up organizing to try and destroy my credibility. Their reason they gave in the discussions was that they were afraid that they were going to lose their Soros funding. I'd try and take it away. They're all funded by George Soros, one of the hedge fund managers who's leading the attack on the euro and Greece. It was very funny to see. One of them had the integrity to CC me and include me in the discussion group, but it's a perfect example of some of the things that go on. So anyway, check out the KPFA censorship story and the Material Omission Part 1 and Part 2. But, you know, these kinds of the battle between truth and propaganda is everywhere and goes on everywhere. So, you know, there's no space that's protected from it. Another good question, United Nations, how to see what is going on. Some of the two best sources of information I've ever used to sort of get a feel for the United Nations. Take a look at Michael Woodywitz's book called Organized Crime and American Power. At some point, I'm going to try and get Michael on the Solari Report. He describes how drug reform that's sort of been developed in the U.S. is being taken globally with the U.N., and you really see the central control that's being exercised. Another is there's a marvelous legislator in New Zealand, Marilyn Waring, who left her career as a legislator in New Zealand and went to the UN to try and understand why the accounting and economic protocols coming down from the UN were destroying their economy. She finally made a video about it. It's called Who's Counting Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics? And it really helps you see the deeper side of the UN. It's important to remember that essentially at the end of the day, the same people who run the U.S. military-industrial complex run the UN, and so, you know, you have enormous overlay between the two systems. Very quickly, please explain the difference between the Austrian School and Keynesian School of Economics. Wonderful question. We're going to be having a Solari report on Austrian economics later this year. Essentially, Austrians like to see the business cycle sort out through the markets. When the cycle when we have a boom and bust, when we hit a bust, an Austrian would say let the market clear itself, whereas Keynesians promote intervention so that when we hit the bust cycle, they're inclined to support government in intervening to take away some of the pain in the cycle, and so you'll see sort of arguments between non-intervention and intervention posited as Austrian or Keynesian. It's important to remember that a lot of intervention we're hearing talk about now is really another round of intervention. The bailout could never have happened without massive intervention by the government. And so you know, the last thing that happened in the boom was the absence of intervention. Those kind of booms could never happen without enormous government intervention. So we're watching, you know, a Keynesian cycle followed by another Keynesian cycle, and I'm much more in the Austrian camp, and nothing could help us more than to have the Austrians rise in terms of influence within the discussion about and debate in Washington in the centers of power. Finally, a comment at the CART on biofeedback machines as a tool to diagnose health challenges. It's an excellent point. I couldn't agree more. If you're not familiar with all of the different kinds of electronic medicine developments that are taking place, they're really worth checking out. Okay, so that's it. And now on to permaculture to profits. It's my real pleasure to introduce to you Eric Tonesmeyer. I've been looking for someone for a while to introduce permaculture to the Solieri Report audience, and was very pleased to hear Eric speak in a conference in Hohenwald, Tennessee last year. Eric is working in a farmer program in Massachusetts, where he's designing and installing a permaculture landscape in concert with immigrant farmers who are starting farm-based businesses. He's also the author of Perennial Vegetables and happens to be the co-author of one of my favorite volumes on anything related to gardening and food. It's called Edible Forest Gardens. And so, Eric, it is a delight to have you.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Okay, so the question that I get the most and always feel inadequate to answer, what is permaculture?
All right. Well, various people have different definitions. One of the ones that I like best, the one-sentence definition, is permaculture is a way to meet human needs while improving ecosystem health.
Uh-huh.
So as opposed to damaging the environment or even leaving it kind of neutral, it's a way to produce our food, our energy, our shelter, and so on in a way that actually benefits or improves the environment. So that's the one-sentence version. To break it down a little bit more, it's a design system. There's some principles in the design process that we can use to tie together different elements to create a functional ecosystem. So that can work on the garden scale, like say you have rabbits and a worm bin and a vegetable garden. If you locate your rabbits such that their manure falls into a worm bin, the worms are going to take that manure, eat it, turn it into worm castings, which is the world's best fertilizer. Then the worm castings go out on the vegetable field, and the vegetable waste, like the broccoli leaves and so on, goes to the rabbits. So you've created sort of a closed-loop system. And it can work on the garden scale, or I've been experimenting with it in the last 5 years at the sort of community-level economic development scale. And that's been a very, very interesting way to think about. When you folks talk about here about reading your or learning to study your financial ecosystem, and this is looking at how to design a financial ecosystem.
Well, one of the ways I think of permaculture is a whole different way of looking at the land around you and thinking about how you can work with that land in a way that is much more productive for. I mean, to me, permaculture can take a home base and convert it to something phenomenally more productive. Whenever I drive around, I'm always driving around and thinking, what if all this gardening and all this landscaping had instead been, had insisted on things we could eat? About 2 years ago, after being introduced to permaculture, I came home and I said, that's it. Nobody plants anything else except things we can eat.
Well, it's funny. One of our I've seen some numbers over the years that our number one crop in terms of acreage in the United States is lawn grass. We spend more money on fertilizer and pesticides for lawn than almost anything else. And
I would argue our number one crop is marijuana.
Well, okay. In terms of acreage, I think one kind of grass is better than the other. More acres of lawn grass. We take it, we put it in garbage bags, and we throw it out.
Right.
It's a phenomenal waste of energy and time. Here at our house, we moved in a couple years ago, and we had just the worst backyard you can imagine. It was all construction fill, chunks of concrete, was clay that had been dumped in and driven over by trucks and stuff. At this point, 5 years later, we have 200 species of useful, low-maintenance, food-producing plants that grow year after year after year, and we have a double handful of fruit for everyone who lives in the house every day from May through October.
That's amazing.
And that's great. And it's a 90 by 45, 90 feet by 45-foot backyard, very small. But you can really, really transform a landscape using some permaculture techniques that are low cost and wildly productive. So I'm with you. Everywhere I drive around, I think, what are people doing?
Right.
So much food could be produced around us.
To me, if you took every community in America and you use permaculture to redo the landscaping and you stop playing the lottery and use that money to reinvest in businesses in the community, you could have a revolution.
Absolutely. And I think that's the kind of, to me, I see permaculture as a tool for self-determination. People
right.
who have food to fall back on are less reliant on governments, for example, and can be less threatened by governments.
Right.
And I think that's a very valuable something to fall back on there.
It's funny, I was talking to Franklin Sanders today about our conversation tonight, and he told me a story that I wanted to tell you. And it was funny that I got asked about the Austrian economics, because it's a story about Van Mises, who's the father of Austrian economics. He was in Switzerland with another economist whose name was Repke, and Repke was gardening lettuce. He was in his front yard, gardening his lettuce. And Van Mises came up to him and said, that's not a very efficient way to grow lettuce. And Repke looked at him and says, yes, but it's a very good, efficient way to raise men. One of the things I've noticed that in this time, I was never the gardening type, as you can probably imagine, is literally trying to convert my landscape to a source of food has reconnected me to the earth in a way that has had a very profound effect. And, it's kept me human. It's a way of staying connected and staying human that I think is very important and has benefits beyond lowering my food bill.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it gets you outside. You get some vitamin D. And I found it's been wonderful here. We're in a highly residential community, sort of a suburban part of a small city. And our front yard has just a wild and crazy tropical edible landscape. We have hardy bananas that come back every year. They don't make fruit, but they have big leaves, and we grow these crazy tropical beans and stuff. And our neighbors, most of whom are from Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, they just can't get enough of us. They think we're crazy. They come by, they want banana leaves to wrap around to make tamales with and stuff,
uh-huh.
wrapping food. And it gets us in so many conversations with our neighbors. We give away, the kids always want to know when strawberries are ripe, and we give away strawberry and raspberry plants. So we've got other people in the neighborhood putting in gardens. Our neighbors on either side are putting in gardens. So there's a real, food is a great organizing tool because people like good quality food. It's
right.
a great way to get to know neighbors and begin other kinds of conversations.
Now, you have a greenhouse, too.
Absolutely. And the thing that I love about the greenhouse is we have an unheated greenhouse, so we don't have a heater in there at all. And right now, I'm in Massachusetts in early March, and I'm eating incredible salads out of there every day with no
wow.
heat. So you could go to the expense of buying a heater and heating it or chopping wood and using that, but there are some low light loving plants, spinach, arugula, beets, carrots, and so on, that will grow with very, very little care in the winter. And to me, if you can, by putting up a minimal plastic structure, get food all winter long with no energy, that's a great example of a permaculture strategy of getting the most bang for your buck.
Now, one of the things I've tried to do on the blog, Eric, is to put up videos, because it's hard to communicate. I find it hard to communicate with permaculture about the extraordinary results you get, you can get in places you would never think you could get results.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going into the desert in the Jordan and, you know, and you know, sort of what Jeff Lawton has done or other very difficult places. But permaculture is not just gardening. It's a very revolutionary way of getting the ecosystem to work for you and vice versa.
Absolutely. And I think it's if we're sort of only fixated on ourselves and our gardens, we miss out on a lot of the larger opportunities that permaculture can provide, partly because we continue to need oxygen and a livable climate and things like that, you know, which are not to be underappreciated. But I think permaculture can be taken to another level beyond what you can do in the home scale. There's a guy named Brad Lancaster in Tucson who first managed to do incredible work in his own garden, but then he figured that the amount of water that falls on Tucson, which is a very dry, I think they get about 8 inches of rain a year, the amount of water that falls on the town in the form of rain is sufficient to meet all their water needs, but it all runs off roofs into the street, goes into gullies, causes flooding, and then disappears. So it creates a problem. Meanwhile, they're bringing in water from the Colorado River hundreds of miles away.
Which is creating all sorts of other problems elsewhere.
And that's a fragile kind of a system to rely on for your water as well. So he's developed a system to create these pits alongside roads that capture the water from the street that would be running off. And he's planted drought-tolerant fruit trees all over town. He's organized his community to do these plantings, particularly of mesquite, which is a tree down there that has these very sweet pods.
Mm.
And they have a pancake breakfast every year where they have mesquite pancakes. They bought a hammer mill so people in the community can grind their own flour from these mesquites, and they're able to produce, in his yard, 10 to 25% of their food for the year on a yard that's about the size of mine, about an eighth of an acre. So that's an example of taking it to the neighborhood level. People have been doing great stuff in schools, and then you can expand out another level to look at that economic development kind of approach to permaculture. We've here in Holyoke, which is sort of like the Rust Belt of Massachusetts,
uh-huh.
Once had 200,000 people, now we have 40,000 people. Really, the factory jobs are all gone and so on. This organization, the Westeros Raices, that I've been part of here for a number of years, has looked at how can we build on the skills and opportunities of the people who are in this community now, most of whom come from the mountains of Puerto Rico, so they're sort of Puerto Rican hillbillies,
Chibaros,
uh-huh. They're called. And how can we build from that? So we started with community gardens, which is a great thing anybody can do to organize a community garden. It brings people together. The value is so much more than the food. Each of our gardens has two elected coordinators. So you've got grassroots democracy on a kind of block-by-block level, which is a very...
Right, and it's hard to find something that really does get people together and getting to know each other.
And you end up talking... You talk over the garden or you talk over the tomatoes and you put up the fencing together and all that. It's been very effective. And from that has grown a number of other initiatives. The recent one, which is really fun, is training teenagers who are coming out of the juvenile justice system to install solar hot water systems.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Which is great because you got people who need jobs, and that's a real growing sector of the green economy. And it's been successful enough that the nonprofit has spun off a corporation, which is now doing that work and hiring the graduates from this program, hiring the best graduates.
Do you know how many hot water heaters they've installed?
You know, I don't. They've only been up and running for a year, but they've been working at a kind of mid-scale. There isn't anybody operating on a sort of – there's huge operations and there's tiny operations.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe they put in 40 or 50 of them this year, not a ton. For year one, that's not too bad, though. And they're learning also some of these, energy efficiency and home energy auditing type stuff,
uh-huh.
Which isn't really the most flashy, exciting thing compared to a big windmill or something, but is a huge way to make savings.
Yeah, it's a huge savings for the people who do it successfully.
I'm just super happy about it. So I love this project. It's called Roots Up Green Job Program.
Uh-huh.
And then the really fun thing is with the farm that I was running, we're right outside of town, about 2 miles from downtown. We manage 30 acres there. So we provide farming opportunities for immigrants and refugees and anybody else who wants to start their own farm operation. We had 22 farmers in 2009 speaking, you know, 6 or 7 different languages.
Right.
We found that that wasn't enough to make it work financially for this site. So we did sort of a community-driven design process using permaculture design to say, all right, what else, what other businesses can we put on this site that would attract customers, purchase products from the farmers, and provide waste products that the farm can use so that everybody benefits. So we're really trying to apply, create this functional interconnection at a economic level. So we have an equestrian operation, a boarding operation, which produces lots of great manure, which we love.
Uh-huh.
That's a resource for us. And there's a farm store. There's a pig roasting operation, which buys pigs from the farmers and brings lots of people to the site. We do great cultural events, and there's folkloric dancing and live music and all kinds of great stuff around that. And
now, the pig roasting has been profitable.
It is very profitable. If you look at pigs, for us up here, if you sell a pig wholesale, you're looking at maybe $1 a pound. Whereas when you roast it, you can get more like $9 or $10 a pound. So
right.
If you don't have a lot of pigs, that's a really good way to go. And it's wildly popular in our neighborhood. People come from, they'll drive an hour or two just for that. And on a good day.
Have you been able to get the restaurants involved?
Well, we own a restaurant facility that we rent out to somebody else. And
uh-huh.
We have worked with a restaurant operator to help get this operation up and running. We're collecting restaurant waste for composting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're collecting waste vegetable oil from restaurants to heat our greenhouse. So we've been
so
able to
you're really integrated.
That's you have to be if you want to make it work financially. So you're interconnecting both on the resource level in terms of waste products or so on, but also how can you set things up so each of these businesses, through being entrepreneurial, which sort of means being greedy, right? Through being self-interested,
right.
Not
right.
Counting on them to be altruistic, how can
right.
they help the other businesses? So our horse businesses, Pasofino Horses is this very fancy breed of horse from Puerto Rico. So when they do shows, people come to the farm. While they're there, they buy some pork, they buy some vegetables to take home, and so on.
Right.
Each of those businesses attracts customers and helps everybody else while they're there is the idea. The,
mm-hmm.
the latest thing we want to bring is a, we have a guy who does saltwater aquariums. He raises coral so that it doesn't have to be taken out of coral reefs. He wants to bring that operation to the farm and have a shark petting tank for the little, you know, foot-long sharks.
Uh-huh.
And a nursery specializing in potted tropical fruit trees like dwarf papayas and dwarf bananas that will fruit in a pot in somebody's window.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to bring these businesses that, through driving their own business successfully, is going to bring other people to the farm, create customers, and sort of revive the local economy and bring.
You're really becoming a food business incubator.
That is absolutely the idea. So we want to build a bigger restaurant, and we have ideas for moving on, but we've had some real success in building around the well, – we have a bakery as well. We have a commercial kitchen where people can rent time to do food processing and so on. We have a relationship with the culinary program at the tech school down the street. So we've been having a lot of fun generating these businesses and thinking not just what are the businesses, but how can they benefit from each other? How can they – use each
have you ever
product.
Used microloans or microfinance?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a microlending program, and then we also, which is for very small amounts of money, up to maybe $1,000, and then we have a local microlender that we work with very closely.
Uh-huh.
And, boy, this makes a huge difference to have access to even a little bit of capital for
especially
the folks we work with who are very low income.
Oh, yeah. Now, if someone wants to learn about permaculture, Eric, how do they do it? And how do I, not just learn about it, but how do I hook into the people who know and are doing permaculture in my area? How do I find the permacultures?
Sure. Well, there's a couple things. In terms of learning just the basic information, there's some great books out there. Introduction to Permaculture is the one I recommend the most. On the gardening level, there's one called Gaia's Garden, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it is very good.
And I have, on my website, I've posted some recommended books and some of the sort of regional organizations so people can find out what's happening where they are.
Okay,
the magazine in the U.S. is called The Permaculture Activist. And then there's Permaculture UK, which covers most of Europe. Between the two of those, if you get a subscription to those, you can find out a lot about what's going on. Their websites are also very informative. And then there are
A lot of people are losing their jobs or their income is dropping, and so they're looking for entrepreneurial opportunities. Do you think learning permaculture can help people, a wide group of people, sort of reinvent their skills and themselves in ways that will generate more income?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say one level of doing that is just to think about a production-based enterprise, a farming-based enterprise. I don't think there's been – I've been assisting people to start farm businesses for about 10 or 12 years now. I've never seen a better time for people to get involved in agriculture. The worse the economy gets, the better it is for farmers at this point.
Well, the interesting thing is, one inflation. If the inflation continues, we're going to see food prices continue to rise.
Absolutely, and the more petroleum prices go up, the more fair the playing field becomes for local farmers in any region.
Right.
I'm looking forward to that in a certain way. We're seeing the California farms, and at this point, you can produce an apple in China or Chile and ship it to the U.S. for less than it costs to grow one here. And that just is really totally backwards. Like so much of our food system, it's completely energy inefficient. And
if you look at it from the standpoint of how much money we're all spending on landscaping, and what good landscaping does to the value of our house, if we integrated those economics with costs, that brings down the cost a lot of growing an apple here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's other fruits that are much easier to grow here than apples as well,
right,
that don't need so much care. That's something that I'm particularly interested in. In terms of learning permaculture, the other big thing is they do these permaculture design courses. Sometimes it's a 2 or 3 week intensive. Sometimes it's a series of weekends. And they're really wildly fascinating places to be, where you become exposed to so many different ideas. What I usually find is that people who take that kind of a course find that the skills they already have are incredibly valuable. Whether you're coming with an accounting background, construction background, whatever it may be, there's a way to plug that into some kind of permaculture-based business and really excel. And certainly for folks who are coming from trades or a business background, that's what's largely lacking in the farm world and in the permaculture world is a real business approach. And we've been one of the fun things about these financial permaculture five-day workshop has been bringing together people with the business background and people with these innovative ideas about production models to come together and say, all right, how can we really bring something new out of this? And I'm seeing in the permaculture world so much interesting entrepreneurial activity happening at this point. It's a lot of very, very interesting. Well, there's the Joel Salatin model, for one thing, who's down in Virginia, who's just been really.
When Joel was at the farm in Summertown a couple months ago, he announced that his revenues were up to $2 million a year. Now, that's a small family farm. He does get a lot of interns, but I think that number sort of caught everybody's attention.
Oh, yeah.
Chickens and rabbits are getting a lot more financially attractive than we realized.
Absolutely. And if you look at the energy efficiency of an operation like that, when it's free of the sort of invisible subsidies that run our food system, it's a wildly profitable operation. And I think we're just going to see more and more that those kinds of operations are really an excellent long-term place to be. And also the quality of life in an operation like that is excellent.
It's very high.
You eat well, you don't need to go to the gym.
I really encourage everyone, if you have time, go to my blog and do a search on permaculture and watch some of the videos that will get you, sort of reminding you what it's like to be with a group of people who are all positive and action oriented and really accomplishing amazing things. Eric, just give your website address again so that everyone can find those resources.
Great. It's at perennialsolutions.org. And the permaculture link there is old. Opportunities for courses and places to read and learn more. There's also some great videos posted on there as well if people are interested.
Now, you're working on a wiki.
Yes, with some other folks. I'm old enough that I can't do this on my own, but I'm now learning from Ethan Roland, who's a guy in his 20s, who's an absolute genius on social media and permaculture. We've developed a wiki that is just about set to launch, where people can share their experiences growing plants, growing polycultures, growing permaculture gardens. And we've already got contributors from several countries uploading information about how they've transformed some barren landscape or another into a beautiful, Garden of Eden, essentially.
Yeah, it's quite amazing what can be done. Things you would never believe are possible, and really very economically. Well, let's turn to Killer at Large. Did you get a chance to see it?
I did.
Well, I find it to be an amazing documentary because it shows you beyond any shadow of a doubt that Washington is very clear, and the businesses, the large food businesses, agribusiness, are very clear about what they're doing. They're literally poisoning our children, and they know it, and they don't care.
That if we ran our food system with the goal of producing food in a way that didn't destroy the environment and that was healthy for people, we'd have to reinvent the whole thing from the ground up. Everything we do is just backwards. And I guess really what the local food movement is doing and the organic movement and so on is really trying to rebuild the system from the bottom up.
Right. For those who didn't watch it, what Killer at Large does is it's a fairly long piece, and it walks you through a series of events in Washington where during the Bush administration is supposedly working to help improve children's eating habits. One of the things they go through is the amount of food that's been put into schools, junk food. And in fact, they show, I was not aware of the fact that that Arnold Schwarzenegger out in California had banned the junk food in the vending machines from schools. And one of the things it does show, Eric, is the introduction of gardening and I'm also aware of permaculture gardens and projects in a variety of different schools. And schools sourcing organic food for their lunches and the importance of that. Has your farming efforts had touched the schools at all?
Absolutely. The farm to school movement and the school gardening movement is really sweeping the U.S. right now, and I believe internationally as well. Some people were better off than us in the first place with that, but we've done a number of things. The most exciting one is we're part of a citywide initiative called the Food and Fitness Collaborative that's really looking at how can we fight child obesity in our city in a big way. So it's a citizen-led drive that has a lot of agency involvement. And we came up with some strategies, some of which I'm very encouraged about. One is we've got a salad bar into one of our local schools.
Uh-huh.
That's buying food from the local farm and working on getting those into more and more of the schools. Part of the challenge is that schools don't even have kitchens anymore.
Right.
It's all produced in one central kitchen and taken out to the individual schools, which have a microwave to heat it up, and that's about it. So figuring out how to get food into those schools, you have to get through the institutional buying process, and you have to have facilities. But a salad bar has been a way for us to get around that a little bit. So that's been...
The food, you know, if you look at the money and the financial ecosystem within the place, government and government-funded institutional purchases of food are a very significant part of the market, including food stamps. And
Absolutely.
So re-engineering those cash flows in ways that make sure that money is going to build up local farms and local food is very, very important.
We've had really good success with that with EBT cards, which is food stamp cards, and WIC coupon redemption. WIC recipients now get farmers market coupons.
Fantastic.
So we've been working to really increase redemption of those in our area because most people don't use them. So we've actually managed to locate our farmers market right in front of the WIC office. And really, at this point, our sales, this is a low-income community, our sales at farmers market come about 70% from food stamps and WIC coupons.
That's
a way to
amazing.
Get healthy food in the hands of people who need it, who otherwise are going to be eating only corn syrup-based products.
And Killer at Large really shows you how much of our health care costs are impacted by having, you know, by feeding unhealthy food to our kids. And how important this is. So we're coming into election season, and what everybody who's listening this can do is when we are in the context of asking or talking to the people running for local elections, these questions of how we get the governor, the government and institutional money swung back to finance local foods, including entrepreneurial efforts, because these are the efforts. If we get that money swung over, Eric, it can create a huge amount of jobs. Am I not mistaken?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And jobs for people who really need them at a time when they really need them and doing something that makes a very positive difference. And that's the sort of permaculture approach, is to find these multifunctional strategies that address multiple problems.
Right. And I'd like to point out these are jobs that, among other things, increase the value of the real estate in your place.
Absolutely.
Because it's much more beautiful and fertile. Okay, well, Eric, we're finished for the evening, so thank you so much. Again, if you could just give out your website again.
Absolutely. Perennialsolutions.org. And it's been a huge treat to be here. I'm a big fan and very happy to help people learn more about
everything you do and for your wonderful books, too, which I have enjoyed tremendously. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming up next week, the Precious Metals Report, we're going to have the Precious Metals Market Update. We're going to have a special report on H.R. 3173, which is Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2009. It's been passed by one side of the House, got to go to the other. We'll see if it's going to make it through the Senate. The movie, we're still on the food theme, is Super Size Me, the wonderful documentary about the young documentary maker who decided he was going to eat only at McDonald's for 30 days and what it did to his health. On March 18th, very interesting Solari report with Jim Norman, former Forbes and Business Week editor, last of Platts Oil Journal, about his book, The Oil Card and Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century. We're going to focus on the Middle East, what's going on, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, the politics of oil, China versus Russia versus the United States. So that's going to be an extra long one. So until next week with the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders, you are in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you definitely need to start one. Good night and good luck.